Hey, everybody. That is Gary Smith.
Hello.
That is Kaz Kenny.
Kapow!
And I am Eddie Bramble, and this is episode 41 of the Blackwater's Edge podcast.
We're rolling along like a freight train, brother.
Hey, man. Start us off with this week's fishing report.
Well, the fishing's been a little manic, I guess, so to say, this week. The tides have been pretty manic, so to say, too, this week.
Ice fishing this morning.
Yeah, no kidding.
Before this cold snap happened, I mean, anybody that's been coming here can tell you we've been catching lots of fish, you know, that pretty much it's been bait most of the days, you know. People are being successful in some other lures, you know, when you can find a warm pocket of water or the sun's been up for a little bit and warmed a little air. You can get something on a MEPS with a minnow or a MEPS without anything or anything like that. Some swim baits are working good. I want to talk a little bit about a new technique that I've been using that I haven't been sharing with a lot of people. I've been sharing it with Eddie and Gary about what I've been doing. So I'm going to go ahead and we'll talk about it. So
at the dynamite?
Yep. No. I'm still trying to figure out I'm going to pay the $15,000 fine for that one. But no, we're not doing that anymore. But no, on a for real, you know, this Lord Jensen. Okay. Now I've used this spoon for years and years and years. Up in the Susquehanna, you know, I this was a go-to for me for a long time for rockfish up there,
exactly,
especially in the fall. You know, it was a nice lure to troll. It was easy to use it, lapping them out there in the open water and things like
yeah,
that.
I was just about to say, most people around here, they're going to know that for rockfish.
Right.
That's what everybody used them for.
But what a lot of people don't know is back in the day, I used to use this rig at Peach Bottom for walleye, and I wanted to talk about this, too, because I see a lot of my old friends up to the north, they're catching walleye right now up at Peach Bottom in the Susquehanna River, and I got to say, I had an opportunity to get up there last week, and I got to get on some real quality fish myself, and I was really impressed to see that fishery still going pretty strong up there. You know, I didn't get any snakeheads. I looked for them. I didn't see them. But it was really good to see 24-inch walleye, you know what I'm saying, and numbers of them, not just myself, but lots of people catching them. So this was an old tactic that I used for walleye up at Peach Bottom. What I would do is I would put it under a bobber. And what I would do is I'd drop my line down, you know, in the deep water, and I would hook a bobber, and I'd have maybe 15 feet, and then I'd let the bobber back behind the boat a little bit as I just trolled real slow. And I would pull this little spoon down low with a minnow tipped on the end of it. So, you know, I got to thinking about crappy fishing and doing this too up there and doing this in some of the reservoirs, you know, back in the day, just dropping a free spoon down with a little minnow on it, small spoon, and dip, you know, jigging crappie and bluegills and things like that. So for the last 2 weeks, I've been trying this this Tony Aceta spoon, and I've been using lots of different sizes. And the two sizes that really seem to be doing the best is, this 13 and this 14. Now, I like this 14 just because it's a little bit longer. You can kind of see that there. You know, it's just a little bit longer as far as bait being concerned, profile-wise. Most of the shad right now are about this size, and that's what really got my mind thinking about this lure. You know, you've heard me talking about it on a lot of the podcasts. I've been looking back at old lures that I used to use and seeing if I can find an implication somewhere for them in this snakehead world, you know? So, this is just a really good lure. So what I've been doing with it is you know, putting this under my standard 1.5-inch weighted bobber or a 2-inch weighted bobber. I'm leaving about a 12 to maybe 14-inch, 15-inch. I mean, it just depends on how deep I am. I mean, some of the places I'm only leaving an 8-inch lead on it, you know, and these would be shallow places like flats and things like that. What I've been doing is I've been taking this and I've been, you know, hooking a snakehead destroyer right through the lips on that hook right there. And this hook, the good thing about these hooks on these baits is even these smaller spoons, they have really, really got a nice gauge hook on them. I mean, they're sturdy. So you're going to be able to hold the snakeheads, I can tell you that. The biggest one that I've got so far on a spoon is about 8.5 pounds. I've lost a few big ones, so I know that the bigger fish are looking at it too. I think what I'm going to try this week is going maybe just one more step up in size and seeing if I can't do this. Anyway, the rig is basically the rounded weighted bobber, have a lead with the spoon, tip it with a minnow, and what I'm doing is I'm making a long cast and I'm staying away from where the fish are and I'm looking for pretty much it's shallow areas that have been hit with the sun, you know, in the afternoon. So I know there's going to be a 5-10 difference degree, you know, in that water temperature from what's out here in that main water. And I know in the evening time, in the afternoon, after that water's had time to get warm, those fish are going to move up to feed. So what I'm trying to do is make these long casts, not to spook the fish, you know, so I'm not, you know, throwing too much at them. Staying back, just taking my time and relaxing. It's just a long cast. You know, I'm cranking about maybe 1, 2, 3, 4 times real quick, just enough to pull the spoon. And you can see the bobber actually kind of bob as the spoon's swaying behind it as you're pulling it, man.
The bobber is bobbing.
The bobber is bobbing, yeah.
That's what they do, man.
And yeah, I mean, bobbers bob, you know, where I'm from, that's what
you'll
they do.
You'll pay all that money for a bobber for nothing.
I know, you know. What I mean? Big bob. But anyway, so I have to tell you, man, this has been, I've been getting lots of bites, man, lots of fish. I mean, I'm catching catfish, I'm catching snakeheads, I'm catching some big crappie. I've caught two bass, about 5 pounds on this thing, you know, the same rig here, so... You know, cat's out the bag. I'm going to go ahead and share it, and it works really, 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 really good. So if you're down here and you hook up with Dame and you get to the store, just grab one. Grab one, go try it. I can promise you, if you do exactly what I'm telling you and you do this, you make these long casts and you just a couple turns of time, just let it sit there, man. The minnow, you know, the minnow is moving that thing around underneath of there. That snake, it ain't going to crash it. You know, you got to get him to follow it. You got to get him to eat it. I had a couple times where... They were just like so lethargic that they would literally follow it on the pool, and I could see them behind it because the water I was in was only like this, and literally I only had the spoon like 4 or 5 inches, man, literally, man. Like that's all it was. And like I pulled across this one flat. I mean, I was in the mud when I cast, and I came out the mud, and I was fishing the corner at Key Wallace. That's where I was, you know. So those of you that don't know, that those corners at Key Wallace, they get really warm in the afternoon. You know, and our guests can probably talk about some of that today, too, when we get to that. But them shallow areas like that, you know, they really, really get warm really, really fast. So if you see water, you know, I'm talking 4, 5, 6 inches somewhere, man, and you see some movement in there, there's probably a pretty good chance that there's a snakehead or two laying up there in that hot mud. Yeah. And there's a good chance there's a snakehead laying up there just looking for an easy meal, you know, where it's a little bit warmer, a little more comfortable laying out there in that cold ass shit, you know what I mean? Because I would be cold too, and I'd be shaking, and I wouldn't want to be there. So, you know, that's something I've been playing with here for the last 2 weeks. And like I said, if you get a chance to check it out, check it out. Again, before it got cold, it was meps. It was a lot of inline spinners. It was a lot of swim baits. It was a lot of... lures you could retrieve slow, you know. I knew a guy that was throwing a 6-inch Rapala in 6-7 inches of water and caught over 20 snakeheads in less than an hour, literally.
It's not bad.
So that tells you, you know, what I'm trying to explain to people is, you know, in that afternoon, that black water that's stained from that decaying pine tree is soaking up that sun, and that mud that's just sitting out there in the wide open is just soaking up that sun. And when that water comes in there, man, bam, it's like the dinner bell goes off.
Well, it's
you
like
know?
This weekend. It's what, just warm 60, back up 65 again, degrees. Yeah. Yeah, Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon.
And I mean, I kind of called this, you know. I mean, we knew it was going to law out today, you know. It's going to law out tomorrow. But like Gary just said, sun's coming back. We're going to have some warm afternoons, and things are going to just fire right back up. The coolest thing about cold weather fishing with snakeheads is this. They don't get that window to get into that spawning mode. You know, they get awakened enough just to get hungry, feed a couple days, and boom, here comes a cold snap again.
And you know? Here I thought the coolest thing about snakehead fishing in winter was the weather.
I got your number today. Hey, man.
Come on, I'm the comedian.
But no, really seriously, I mean, it gets cold like this. I know somebody who fished today, and they caught them on 1/8-ounce chatterbaits real slow with a minnow.
That's your favorite.
That's one of them. So we might as well talk about that too. Some expenses. So there's that 1/8-ounce chatterbait. And for those of you that saw the post yesterday, don't forget to go over to Daryl Willie and check out the Kaz's crazy crappy flapper.
Speaking of addiction baits, Gary, what happened to those addiction baits you had last week?
Yeah, we want to talk about them today. Fine. Why don't you show them what you got?
They're all hanging on the end of the rod. They're doing just fine. They're probably going to get wet.
Now, I told y'all last week, he wanted to just take out the package and look at it.
That's right.
As soon as it came out the package, he wasn't coming back here.
We knew what was happening, so it's okay.
I said to him before the show, I said, Gary, you got that bait? He said, yeah, here it is.
Yeah. We're good friends if you can't use them.
I know, that's right? Right. I mean, another bait that's still running hard and doing good, and they're catching crappie, they're catching bass, they're catching everything, you know, is the 3-inch Mr. Twister. Oh, now, yeah. If you're crappie fishing down places like Newbridge or Aries or Drawbridge and places, you know, I like Panfish Assassins. That's a really, really great bait here, you know. I got some lures last year from Bustin' Baits. I think Carl Ward gave them to me, a couple packages of them things, and I tried them last year, and they worked very good, too. So, bright colors have seemed to be what's working for me. That's just me in particular.
Shiny.
Yeah. You know, MEPS, it's been number fours. It's been number fives. The cold. You know, number threes is where I think you want to start looking
minimum,
now.
Yeah.
And it's a smaller hook, so you know you're going to have fun with it. You know what I mean? You're probably going to lose a lot of fish.
You better have fun with it,
right? But I, you know what I'm saying, you're going to lose a lot of stuff. As far as around the area, what's going on? You know, over in the Nanticoke, it's blue cat, blue cat, blue cat. Man, they're catching some giant blue cats over there. They've got some giant blue cats over in Marshy Hope. For those of you that are watching Cornflower from the BigBlueCatLife.com page, you know, check out what he's doing over there. Man, they're catching some 70-pounders plus over there, man.
It's not bad.
And I know they had one last week come unbuttoned because I saw the video, and oh, my God, man, I've seen the 70-pounders on film, and I don't know what this thing was, but, I mean, it was big, big, big. So what else we got going on? It's been rockfish around a lot of the bridges. White perch are everywhere. The last of the trout are leaving out now, too. I don't want to cut you off, Eddie, with our guest today. We got Mr. Tim here today, Mr. Tim Robbins from Oyster Bay Fishing.
Stealing my thunder.
Oyster Bay, Fishing Bay Oyster Company. I go again, Oyster Bay Fishing Company. Fishing Bay Oyster Company. I just want to ask him, Tim, I know you guys are netting a lot out in the bay. What are you guys seeing down low? What are you guys seeing out there, what you guys are doing?
Well, the perch are still to the shoreline. You got to find them because this time of year, last month, they were kind of spread out everywhere. But now they school up tighter and tighter. So you if you want to fish around the shores, you got to do a lot of moving until you find them. Wind on a shore is good because it stirs up the bait. What's coming out of them is bloodworms and minnows and little toadfish and all that kind of stuff. See, if you got minnows, you should be good. Bloodworms is good too. They're even actually eating little teeny crabs.
Huh.
The crabs are still active and they're only about the size of you. Little
finger,
pinky finger. Yeah, they've got them in there. We even had one that had a full big shrimp, not a grass shrimp, but a big one.
They even had one of those in there.
He was hungry.
Yeah.
Dirty little bastard.
The other place to look for perch is to go out at the lower end, you know, the mouth of the rivers, find the oyster rocks that are right to the edge of the channel, and minnows and bloodworms is good there too. Shrimp. Stuff like that, you know, 30 foot of water, 25, 30 foot of water.
A lot of folks been asking me the last couple of days about, are we seeing any more drum? We seen any more trout? When's the last time you guys saw trout in the net?
Probably last week.
Last week.
Yeah, last week we probably had one spotted trout. The red drum, when they had a little snap, we had the other week, last week, they disappeared. And when it got warm again, we started seeing two or three of those. I would say after this, we probably won't see any.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're probably heading on out. It's still a lot of little teeny spot, about 3 or 4 inches long. Huh. You know, those rock are after those.
How about that?
You know, I mean,
the rock bite's been pretty good. I mean,
when we see these little, when we see LYs and the spot, we'll see rock. If you don't see them, then you won't see any rock.
Right.
Nanticoke should have rock all along the shorelines there, down toward Clay Island, Middle Ground, all that area.
They seem to hang there a little longer than
other
places.
Yeah, they'll hang there until December. You from like Sandy Island Cove on up to probably Greens Island and that area, all along there, they'll be along the shore. They'll be out to the edge of the channel.
I tell you what, this is going to be a really, really good show today, folks. And we're going to hear a lot of good stories and a lot of information, a lot of things that will take somebody a lot of years to learn some of the things we're going to talk about today, including myself. End of the fishing report pretty much is, like I said, catfish. Now, I am talking to some guys down in Salisbury. Let me talk a little bit about that. Some of the ponds down there are starting to pick up with crappie and panfish and things like that. So if you're looking for crappie, you're looking for some big bluegills, you might want to go down that way and look around a little bit and maybe talk to some of the locals there. I did talk to some people over in Delaware. Some of the ponds over there are starting to turn on with crappie and big bass. So if you want to go and catch some big bass, those would be some good places to look. Smithville Lake bite's been pretty temperamental, just like normal. It gets a lot of pressure in that lake. I'm hearing some nice bass that are being caught. I'm hearing that the snakehead numbers are a little more this year. The guys are seeing in the Smithville Lake that they saw last year, and we do know that they're still catching plenty at the spillway below Smithville Lake. So Y Mills, talked to some guys last week up my Y Mills, not much going on there. Still catching some snakeheads, a few big bass, some bluegills in the spillway, pickerel here and there. Down Barron Creek, you know, down Mardella Springs, a lot of good fishing in there. You know, crappie, bass, a lot of snakeheads there that could use some attention, man. Get down there and get them out of there if you can. You know, that used to be one of my favorite crappie places to go. And, I mean, I used to catch 18-inch crappie there, 2.5 pounds, man. Like giants back in the day, seriously, before that spillway ever broke through. So, I mean, that's what I got today. I didn't mean to interrupt our interrupt your introduction, but go ahead, Eddie.
Yeah,
let's talk about our guest today.
Yeah. So, as Kaz has already said, our guest today is Mr. Tim. And so, Tim, for those who don't know you, why don't you tell them a little about yourself?
Well, I've been in Dorchester County all my life. My wife says I was born from the dirt here. Raised here and worked on the water pretty well. Yeah, worked on the water all my life, doing something, whether it was crabbing, fishing, done a lot of fishing, oystering, done some new ventures like aquaculture, which is something that kind of took off in the state here because of the way the oyster situation is. And that's pretty well it. I'm just, you know, I love the fish. I love the hunt. You learn a lot how to rod and reel fish from commercial fishing a lot of times because you know where you're finding fish, and the fish is usually the same spot. Something about those spots. Crabbing, I've shedded crabs. That's what I've been doing for probably since I was 16. Shedding soft crabs in the summer, fish in the fall, oyster, all that kind of stuff.
Let's talk a little bit about your parents. Let's talk about your family. Let's talk about where Tim came from and how we got where we are. So what can you remember as a child?
You said you came from the dirt, so
tell us about your roots. That's what my wife says. I don't know where she got that.
Is it clay? Is it topsoil? I mean, what kind of dirt are you,
brother? I
think
we're all from the dirt anyhow. Yeah. We go back to dirt.
Right. Tell us about growing up. What was growing up like down there? Tell us what life was like living on the water as a child.
It was fun. I mean, it was always something to do, and I love being outdoors. So at 5 years old, I wanted to go out with Dad crabbed. You know, he worked on the water full time doing something. So when summer came, I thought that was great. I hated Labor Day. That was the end of going back to jail, you know. So at 5 years old, I mean that. That is not a joke. But anyhow, 5 years old, I wanted to go crabbing, and my mom says the only way he go crabbing, he has to wear a life jacket at all times. So I had to wear that, you know, old big fluffy life jackets they had back then. And the first day I was so sleepy I didn't get up and go. But after that, I got up that next morning and realized I'd missed going, and so the next day after that, I was ready to go.
Every day.
And so, I mean, you know, what was going to do on the boat 5 years old? But I was introduced to learning how to crab and how to work the water and all. I can say my dad taught me well. And, you know, then when I got big enough, I was culling crabs. And I can remember how the market changed from before. They just baled everything into barrels 5 inches up, and it went to the picking houses. And I can remember as a kid that the big crab market had just started. And Kaz, you're like this. The big crabs had to be fat and 6 inch plus. They were $6, $8, and $10 a bushel.
Wow. Oh, my God.
For a bushel.
God,
a bushel.
I have my crab thing coffers on here. Let hear all this.
But that's
man.
What they were. They were had to be 6 inches. And
God, that's awesome.
And, you know, so they went from there. That market exploded. Hmm. I can remember I was crabbing by myself. I went on my own. I got a skiff with a 6 horsepower and went crab scraping. And that 6 horsepower, I had her wide open. That's all she would tow that scrape. And I was making some money at 16 years old. Well, I was making some money.
At $6 a bushel.
No, they'd gone up by then. They'd gone up. But shedding crabs had, the soft crabs had went up a lot by then, right. And I was catching some crabs and shedding some crabs, and I was doing good. I got a car that winter, and then that summer I paid that car off, you know. And I remember being down on the dock, you know, fooling my stuff, and this man come down there and was talking to me and asked me, you know, different questions, and he was like, "How much you making?" I told him. He says, "It's men on jobs ain't even making that," you know. So it was just a fun, like, you know. I can remember we're on a boat with Dad and my brother. We both were on the boat at the same time, which, you know, that, you know, brothers, you know how that can be. You know, we'll all be fighting and everything. But anyhow,
he was more referee than Waterman.
Yeah, he could be. Yeah, yeah. It's times, you know. But, you know, fish would start breaking when we'd come on the end of the line. We'd throw our lines out. We were catching them little snapper blues with spreader rigs. And time the boat would stop, we would have a line overboard. And it was just a fun time. It was so much adventure for kids, you know, with the variety of stuff that was going on. And, you know, and the amount of crabs that it was then was unreal. You know, when he first saw those automatic dippers, he was like, well, I don't know what good that would do. You wouldn't get on the line because it was just loaded up, you know, and the amount of crabs we had then and on. It was just a different day and different time. And things had to change, and things have changed. But I can remember him telling me a lot of the stories of you know, back years ago when they all the picking houses that were around. It was whole, they were everywhere. Picking houses were everywhere. And they had the steam whistles on the ticking house, and the women that picked at the evening when they took in the crabs, they would blow those whistles for how much crabs it was, hundreds of pounds, how many times it was, so they would know how many crabs they were going to have to pick in the morning.
Wow.
How about that?
You know, you can hear it in late, you
so
know.
So anyway, they can sleep in or get up early and go to work.
That's right. they come and pick them up, but you know, it was to let them know what they had facing them. No refrigeration at that time. Now, this is my dad taught me. It's not my time. And they had screened in concrete floors and screened in, and they would take and steam the crabs and shovel them out on that screened floor. They were screened in so no flies could hit them, and the next morning they'd be picking those.
Huh.
They weren't refrigerated.
Wow.
I mean, it just
health department wouldn't like that.
No, they wouldn't like that now, but you know, but that's how things were.
That goes back to people when they ask me at the time, how long can I eat that crab after I cooked that?
Now you know.
Give them that story.
Yeah. You know, I think the coolest thing right here that you're talking about, and I heard you say the one word, fun.
Yeah,
fun. You know,
adventure.
And this is the thing, like I know for me as a kid when I came here, man, I was just blown away at what I saw, because this was different life than I was used to. This is the thing that kills me. You just said it, you know, you make good money, you know, and here's the thing. It kills me when somebody walks up to me here and says, hey man, come borrow $100. Because literally, man, I learned as a kid here, probably the same way you did, I could go in this ditch and I could trap minnows and sit out on 16 with a sign that said minnows for sale, $5 a scoop.
Yeah.
You know, there were ways to make ends meet. There's always been ways to make ends meet here if you look for it. That's my point. You know what I mean?
That's part of the American problem. You're worth what you put into it. Yeah. And a lot of people have forgotten that.
I think the most amazing thing here, there is when I came here, like that attraction that he just described was the first thing that I felt here, you know? When I got to go into these woods and just walk and didn't have to tell somebody where I was going, and just walk for hours, flipping logs, climbing trees, man, getting stung by bees, man, tasting stuff just to see what it smelled, you know, I wonder what it tastes like. It smells good, you know what I mean? That kind of stuff, you know? No, I didn't eat any rat turds or anything like that while I was out there as a kid.
I wouldn't go there.
Man. I saw you. I knew what you was getting ready to do, comedian. But no, but seriously, I mean, that's the coolest thing, you know? The old stores that I see in the pictures, you know, we were touching on that a little bit beforehand. When you were a kid, people didn't drive. Talk about the stores and why they were important here to people, you know?
They had so many stores around. Now, when I was coming up, some of them had been closed and all. But when my dad told about how the stores were everywhere, because it wasn't a lot of cars, so that everybody had to walk, and all the stuff was brought down to these stores, and people bought everything at stores.
Time out. You mean to tell me people walked around here with mosquitoes like this back in the day?
Funny.
Different world. Did you have thermocells?
Yeah, thermocells didn't exist back then.
No, I'm just kidding. But no, seriously, keep going.
They had stores everywhere, and you bought everything at that store. Now, you got to travel now with cars and all, that was the demise of the stores that were around there. I mean, it's places. Clarence Pritchett told me before he died, he told me about all these stores that were around there. And how many? He's there in Bishop's Head, and it's not very far to the Tedious Creek. He told me how many stores were between him and the creek.
How about that?
Wow. I mean, you wouldn't believe it. It was just like they were everywhere.
I've always wondered how this store survived through all these changes in the years.
Because it's not a town here, and you're stretched out a little bit. When I was a kid, Church Creek, there were the two Richardson brothers. They both had stores. Post office sold little cakes and pies and stuff.
Wow.
Freeland Phillips had a store, and just about the time that I was
the post office sold cakes?
Oh, yeah, she sold little cakes and honey buns cool. and stuff like that. And then Rue Vickers had a store. And B.J. Lenthicum's, that's where they started selling cars in Church Creek. Because if you were in horse and buggy,
they had a car lot in Church Creek?
Yeah. Right where the parking lot is now. That was B.J. Lenthicum's, which was a big Chevrolet dealer in Cambridge.
Started
right there. Had an Undertaker. And we had it all. So you could, and plus, I forgot about Sam James' store.
Mm-hmm.
That was there, too.
Yep.
And you could go from Lakesville, Crapo, wherever, to Church Creek and home in a day in a horse and buggy, but you couldn't go in Cambridge. That was a 2-day trip.
Wow.
So Church Creek at one time was a pretty big little town for
right. It was a popping place.
Where I lived cool. at, it was so many, so it was a load more people than we have now.
Yeah. I mean, see the old pictures.
See the houses fell down and all that kind of stuff, but it was a load more people, and that's why it supported the stores.
Right.
And you could buy anything. Heck, my first gun I bought at the store down there. He had the license to sell that stuff, ammo, anything you wanted you could get.
Huh. Yeah.
Because they had the connections to get it. You could get anything, clothes. I remember they bought clothes and everything there. I'm not kidding you. It was everything that you could buy that you could buy around at that time. You could buy at the stores.
You guys don't remember catalogs. Like Sears.
I remember the Christmas catalog from Sears.
There and pick out all the stuff that you want.
3,000 page catalog.
Actually, look, so I was talking about this. Here's a good funny story to drop in on this real quick, okay? So I was like 8 years old, and my mom babysitted a friend of mine, right? So we got the Sears catalog 1 year, and this is kind of a funny story. So we were sitting there flipping through, and they had the section where the women were in the bathing suits and the bras and the panties, right? So I look at Brian. His name was Brian McVeigh. I know you're out there somewhere, Brian McVeigh. I just threw you under the bus. But anyway, we were kids, and I started racing with a pencil, eraser on the pencil, right? I started trying to erase the bras and panties off everything, right? We weren't smart enough to rip the pages out, you know? And he's like, look, man, you can probably take their panties off. Oh, it didn't work on that. Let's try this one.
You got to tear the page out and hold it to the light.
I did like 3 pages of this, right? So I'd shut the book and go put it back on the magazine rack, because that's what we had, a magazine rack back then, you know what I mean? So Brian goes home, I go to bed. Next day I get up, and Mom's like, "Dad's coming, I want to talk to you." I'm like, "Yeah, what's going on?" She's like, "It's catalog." I'm like, "You know what happened to this right here?" I said, "Oh, Brian McVeigh, the boy you babysit yesterday, he was over here racing all the bras and panties. Told me he would show me, man. And it was all him, not me, Mom." Right? So I threw him under the bus, man. I went on my merry way. She called his mother. Next thing you know, man, we got all kinds of crap going on. So all you kids out there that got the Sears Christmas catalog, you can't erase the bra and panties off the women, okay?
It's a digital catalog now.
Oh.
Actually, I think Sears is about to go out of business anyway. So.
Anyway, it's probably my fault, you know. So. Anyway, I just had to throw that in there. Sorry. Back to the stores.
Oh, man.
It was like you said, it was a different time back then.
It was a different time. I mean, they had told me, says you could look out the yard. People walk across the yard. They walk the shortest route, you know, and the roads were nothing but shells. So you couldn't go very fast.
Right.
The tires wouldn't last. They told a story about they had a graduation up to the Crapo school. I think that was a high school at one time, I think. And these boys got together. They were going to go up there. Well, everybody was going to go up on the bus, and they decided they were going to ride their car. I think they got as far as Wingy Dot. They had so many tires blow out that the bus was coming back. Because you repaired the tire, you didn't just change the tire, you repaired it on the road.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you pump it up, put a new tube in, or whatever it was. That was called a patch, and
not like today.
Triple A ain't gonna come to you then.
What was your first car, Tim? What was your first car?
My first car was a 70 Olds Cutlass. I wish I had that thing back.
Four speed or automatic.
Automatic.
How long does she last? How long you have her for?
Well, I'll tell you what, it lasted two or three of our family members.
Okay.
It just went to the next one.
Because a lot of the guys that I talked to here, their first car didn't make it 3 weeks once That's they right. got into it and had a couple beers.
I didn't turn her up, but she had some power. But that way, I liked her. I wished I had one of them back.
We were talking a little bit before the show about, you know, back then shipping and things, how they ship stuff, how they kept things cold. We didn't have refrigeration units. We didn't have walk-ins. We didn't have all that good stuff back then.
Yeah, well.
Tell the folks a little bit about how they used to pack the stuff in the boxes and crates you were talking
about.
Well,
the salt crabs, which my dad had experience with, and that's I ended up going over and shedding salt crabs. He used to work for his uncle, Roland Mills. And he had like over 100 floats at that time that
wow.
he was,
That's
yeah. And they would just have so many salt crabs back then. It was just unreal the amount of crabs it was.
And you were saying also that like when they shed them out, if they didn't sell what they sold back then, they didn't freeze things. They just threw them back.
There was no frozen salt crabs back then.
There was no frozen market at all.
No, right? It was none. And everything went into the wholesale markets. And anything that wouldn't make it up there, or if it was dead when it got there, they would deduct it off of your money. Huh. And so when they went to pack them up, if they knew it wasn't going to make it, they just tossed it overboard. And all the dead ones was tossed overboard. It was no frozen crabs. So what ended up happening is my uncle decided he was going to go directly to restaurants and sell. And he told him, I'll supply you. Just make sure you buy from me. I'll make sure you got crabs. And what they did, they started freezing some of them. So what ended up happening is at times when the salt crabs would get kind of on the scarcer side, they would start saying, well, you want to try some of these frozen ones? They were like, I don't know, you know, that kind of stuff. I'll try a box or two, whatever. They got so they liked it because they didn't have to clean them.
Right.
So they started buying them, and in a matter of a short period of time, they went from selling everything live to cleaning everything and selling them like that.
Right.
And that's where the frozen crabs.
There's a lot of companies that do that. They don't even sell them live here at all.
Yeah.
You know?
So that just switched completely over to what his market was for frozen salt crabs. And at that time, when they were shipping them live, they used to go around the shores and get it's eelgrass. It's that bladed
right.
grass.
Mm-hmm.
When it dries out,
this is how they were packing them.
They would get around and get a whole skiff with a pitchfork because it was loads of it around the shore. They call it COs, and they would go pay somebody, you know, just a few dollars, go shovel up a whole skiff load of it, and they would put them in the house there. And what they did when they had wooden boxes, they shipped them in. And what they did, they put the crabs in there, put the grass and the paper and all that kind of stuff. And they didn't have the refrigeration, so what they did, they had ice trucks deliver big, huge chunks of ice. I mean, the ice tongs,
yep.
Get a hold of them. And they had a grinder down there. I can still hear that thing going down there. They would throw it in there, and that thing would chew it right up, and then they have it in the bottom, right? It would shovel ice on top of those salt crabs, on top of that paper and all, and it would be shipped away like that. And it would keep them for forever, you know, that ice melting into that. Those crabs.
So I guess the paper and the seaweed kind of create an insulation boundary between the ice and the crabs.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
They wouldn't get too cold, they would have that water, that moisture.
Cold water going down.
It's funny hearing you talk about the ice because my dad used to be in the ice business, and I remember going to work with him, and giant blocks, I mean, 300-pound blocks of ice, that's what they were.
They were like
and
this long.
I mean, it was just amazing, the process for these 300-pound blocks of ice. It was just neat to see.
And that's the way they shipped them. Now I asked him one time how many they fished up at one time, and I forgot how many he told me, but he did said one time they sent a ton truck up loaded with salt crabs to Baltimore, and by the time they come back, they had another load that would fill that ton truck of salt crabs. He told me how many boxes they did one time of fish up. That was the most they'd fished up, but they would have boxes and boxes and boxes. It just unreal the amount of salt crabs that would come through them places.
How many people worked at this operation? I mean, was it a lot of people that were employed through this, or just
seemed
a
like
handful?
To me? It seemed like it was about a half a dozen.
Half a dozen.
Yeah, because you had always. He said sometimes when they had a lot of crabs going, they had them overboard in floats. These weren't pumped. They had the wooden slat floats out into the crab pounds, what they call them. They would put poles up and put slats around to break the sea off, and then they had all these floats tied right alongside each other, and they would go there and fish them up. He says sometimes when it's so many crabs that they would start on one end and start fishing up. By the time they got done, they just turned right around. They were just constantly hauling.
They were just constantly hauling.
I remember going in skiffs and just hauling soft crabs up there and letting somebody pack them, and they'd be out there fishing them, and just it would just continually be a going when they were shedding a lot of crabs.
What's the biggest soft crab or crab, either one that you ever saw?
Well, I never measured them, but one year, crab scraping, we had a lot of crabs, of big crabs that came in to shed in Tedious Creek one time, and it was very unusual. And we caught a lot of them, and they were so big that we were using two pieces of paper to wrap them, and when they packed them as whales, they only packed a dozen in a box. We packed a dozen. This is myself.
There's 18 now in the box.
Yeah, but we could only get a dozen in there.
Wow.
I've never seen anything like that, and it continued for a while.
So to give the people an idea, I mean, I can get 18 7-inch soft crabs in a box. It's a tight fit. You know what I mean?
What's a box? A beer?
Yeah, well, not beer. Even a beer flat. No, they're not even as big as a beer flat.
The white
box. They're smaller than a beer flat. So, I mean, really, you're probably talking about a... God, that's got to be a 9-inch crab.
I've never seen anything like that. We had to take two 12-inch papers and slide them together like this and then wrap the crab like that because the price had fell. So we were cleaning so many, and we were getting them stacked up in the floor, and I was catching them, and Tommy was cleaning them. And finally, I said, well, I'm getting ready to go back. He says, no, you can't. He was losing ground. He stopped me. But they were right beside our door. We were just catching them, and they were huge. Saw crab. I've never seen that many big for that long, and so you know that was unusual. That was one of them anomalies we've never saw since.
I tell you, this podcast is flying by in time. I just looked and seen we're 40 minutes. So whoever out there wants a sticker, okay, say I love oysters. That's what you got to write. I love oysters.
Not Oyster Bay.
Not Oyster Bay.
rural life, Dorchester County, especially in the last 40 years is dramatically changed.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, you remember.
Oh, yeah.
How many cannon houses were down there?
Oh, my.
Good Lord, man.
See, it was. They're falling down now. You know, you see where they were at, and they're falling down. And, yeah, the land's changed so much. They're not growing the tomatoes.
All the cannon houses, 12 o'clock every day, whistle blew.
Let's start talking about oysters. So I want to talk a little bit about this. We got so many things I want to talk about. We don't have a lot of time. You know what I mean? We're 40 minutes quick. Now. How did you get in the oyster business? I know that things have changed over the years. You know, watermen have made their adjustments to fine-tune what they're into. This seems to kind of be your niche a little bit here, you know? Talk to us about oysters. Tell us what you do. What does Fish and Bay Oyster Company do? I know you do some cage stuff. You explain to the people the difference between a farm-raised oyster, a wild oyster, how you do it. Let it rip.
The wild oyster... we've had our ups and downs in the industry, and I've oystered since I got out of school. I went to college, and
you've been oystering over 40 years.
Yeah, we've had our ups and downs. We had a near crash on the oysters. They brought power dredging in order to pull the shells back up. We were having a rock sunk and everything, which right now it's doing well. We've got more oysters in market now. Phenomenal spat catch this year. A lot of oysters. But years ago when we were having our problems, state of Maryland opened it up for leasing, and, some watermen did, some watermen haven't, they just haven't gone that way. And that's, you know, it's choice.
Let me ask this question. The purpose of the state opening up the bottom for lease, was that to help to, make the oyster population better? What was the thought behind doing that?
Well, at the time,
Why take the ground from the bay and make it private if it's been public?
Well,
for so
they made certain conditions. You just can't go to a public rock and take that in. It had to be certain conditions. The one of the leases I've got was my grandmother and grandfather's lease from back probably 1900, and
so Oyster Bottom's been being leased now for hundreds of years?
Oh, it's been leased for a good while, but it was great. It was a lot of restrictions on it.
Okay.
And In fact, they even had a law years back that no more bottom could be leased in Dorchester, but it went through the state legislature. It can be all over now. You can't go to public bottom and just up and lease it. It's not lawful to do that, even though there's been some controversy back and forth of some bottom that probably shouldn't have been leased was, but you know how that happens, what happens with, you know, government stuff. But that's what was supposed to have happened. It was supposed to have been barren bottom, but if, you know, I'm not too much into the bottom lease stuff. I like the cage stuff. I do have that as extra, the 38 acres I've got in upper part of Fishing Bay, which was my grandmother's and all, and I took that in and got it back from the state. And but the cage oysters is where you take a cage. It's different ways you can do it. Mine's on the bottom. It's a 3x4 foot cage, double layer, and you put the oysters in that cage and put a buoy on it, and you let them grow in that cage. You have water flow that goes from underneath of it, the sides of it, the top of it, and
so it's floating off.
No, it's got legs on it, maybe a 6-inch tall off the bottom, and it's stationary. It's heavy. You're gonna have to have a boom rig to handle it, and. The oysters are in those cages. Tide flow goes back and forth through the cage and feeds the oyster. Hmm. We use an oyster in those cages called a triploid. It's an oyster that's two oysters together that spawned in, but they don't spawn. They use all their energy to grow. They don't spawn. See, the natural oyster.
So the seed that you buy doesn't reproduce. Seed that you buy just grows, and you sell it. You're done with it. So you're not taking spat from what you're getting and reseeding. You're buying seeds to reseed with, correct? Is that how?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you're buying the triploid. Now, the ones that I have on my bottom lease are what they call a diploid, which is it's the natural oyster we have here. And we set them in tanks on bags of shells, and we dump them out on the bed, and they are a wild oyster. They will spawn.
How big are they when you start to when you put them in the cage to start growing?
I buy them at 5 mil.
So show them with your fingers what 5 mil is.
Probably for like that.
So you're talking about maybe two centimeters, maybe.
Not even.
No, it's about like that.
Yeah, you're talking.
You're
like,
talking
like
about half the size of a penny, a quarter of the
size of a penny. It's even.
You're talking like
even smaller than that here.
Yeah, talking like the tip of your pen. Like the tip of your pen.
It's real small. Yeah. And
the seed, does the seed go into the cage, or do you grow the seed somewhere else to get the size to go in the seed?
I put the seed in bags.
Okay.
A 4 mil bag, and I buy them 5, so they set in there and don't stick into the bag. Now, some people even go to the larvae and they set it on their own microcorch, what they call it. It's almost like dust, and they send it on there and then grow them up in their nursery.
Wow.
Since I'm the only one doing it, I cut all that work out. Right. I better pay more.
Right.
And so when I buy it, it goes into bags and they'll go into the cage. When they get big enough, when they start expanding, they'll take and sometimes go 3 or 4 times in a matter of 2 or 3 weeks. So you put about a gallon in a bag, and you go next time to it in 2 or 3 weeks, and it's 4 or 5 gallons.
Wow.
How long from the size you buy them, the tiny like that, to marketable?
Probably 13, 14 months.
That's amazing.
It's amazing the growth that they have. When they grow, when they start in the spring, when the water gets up around 50 degrees, they take off. They will grow on up to about June or July, and then all of a sudden they just stop. And I don't know whether I think the meats have to catch up with the shell, what I think. Hmm. And then when it hits into August, September, they take off again. Yeah, well, they stay fat. They're fat. They stay fat. The only time they might not be as fat as they usually are is at the end of winter, because they go dormant in the winter, and they don't quite get as fat then because they're not eating anything, and I assume because they don't grow.
I mean, I tell you, the oysters that you've shared with me, I mean, they are salty, they are plump, they are full. I mean, I'm not lying. I've never got an oyster from him in my life that was dried out inside or didn't have water or was
How many acres you say you have?
5 for the cages, and 38 for the bottom lease.
So the 5 acres, how many bushels can you produce off it? How many cages can you put on that?
I would say I could probably put 300 cages on that. But I'm actually getting ready to get more, because what happens is the buoys are going to be too close for my big boat. So I'm going to have to expand a little bit to give me room to move around in there. And so they grow like that. And then when you pull them up from that initial time, you put them in bags, you put them in, you spread it out and get like a gallon in another bag, start over like that. And the next time you go into a bigger bag. And then from then on, you'll sort them out and start putting them in the cages. Once you start getting them in the cages, they got more water flow and they'll grow faster.
So yeah. You hand them 5 or 6 times while they're growing them?
Should about 3 times.
Yeah.
And once they go into cage, I don't handle them until I want to sell them.
So, what's your yield on that normally, for as far as what you buy and goes to market? What's your loss there?
And
I would say, I'll tell you the truth, I don't tumble none of mine.
Right.
And I think that kills some of them. I would say probably 75%.
Wow.
Because I don't have many dead ones.
That's
where you lose them is when they're real small. Once right. they get big, you don't lose
yeah,
them.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the small ones. It's like, you know, and you're
so
going to have loss.
So the tumbling kills them? Is that what it is?
I see more dead loss with people who tumble them.
Well, it makes sense to me. It's like,
you beat the bills off, and
right.
I think,
right.
you know.
You throw me in a cage and bounce me around 10 times and send me up there, I'm going to be a little hurt. You know what I'm saying?
I don't think it hurts you too bad.
Put in the dryer for a little while.
That's just, now, people do it. But and I, you know, that's neither here nor there. I just don't do it because the place I've got, the oysters grow really good shape. Some places they don't grow good shape, and you got to tumble them in order to get them in good shape. And where I'm at,
if you got a muddy bottom, I guess you got to tumble them just to get the mud off of them, don't you?
No, they kind of keep yourself clean. Yeah, they kind of, you know, they're all tight there together. They kind of keep yourself clean. And but I got a real good clay bottom there. And it seems like they will grow, even if you jam them up and then spread them out later and they're kind of long, and they'll sort themselves right out and make a nice-looking oyster. Huh. And so it's just everybody does it different. And when you find the way that works, and it might not be like somebody else does.
Right.
And so whatever I'm doing, I've got it down to what
it
works.
It's working for you.
Everybody has a niche, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
everybody finds
that
one niche for them that works. You know, and before I forget about it, if anybody wants to get that sticker right there, you need to write, I love my country.
Mm-hmm.
So, Tim, look, I want to talk a little bit about fishing and hunting. I know you like to do both. So,
oh, yeah.
Before we talk about fishing, let's talk about hunting. So, what do you like to hunt here in Dorchester County?
Ducks, and ducks. Deer season is just the time between duck seasons. Hurry up and get over with. I even took my deer hunting. I can't sit in the stand. Just can't. I'm just like, I can, but it's just one of them things I have to go out and jump my deer and shoot him. Almost like with my shotgun.
Before I forget, and then we're going to start talking about fishing. Mr. Tim has graciously donated this fish scaler from Joy Fish. This is stainless steel. It's all stainless steel. It lasts for a long time. Tim, tell me a little bit about that fish scaler here you sell.
Oh, I love them. It does the job, and I tell people, well, you know, it'll last forever. just don't drop it overboard. It won't swim.
It can't swim.
You have to come back and get another one. But it's great. I use them myself, and so. Nice fish scaler.
I've known you for several years, and I was real honored that you said you would come on here and do this for us. And, you know, for those of you who don't know Tim, I've known Tim for a long time. My mom was sick, you know. I mean, I didn't know this guy. This is kind of like the first time we kind of ever met. And, you know, we were just talking to one another. We weren't even doing business or anything like that. We were just being pals, you know, fishing on the side of the road. And he asked one day how things were going. I said, yeah, I told my mom wasn't doing good. She had to have some heart surgery, this and that. And I believe you sent me a message that night and said, hey, I just wanted to touch base with you. I don't know you a lot, but we lit a candle at the church, and we got your mom on my prayer list. And I was like, you know, man, that's just kind of the way people are here, you know. And somebody like me that's not from here doesn't know how to take some of those things sometimes, because where I'm from, that means you want something from me. You know what I'm saying? So I've been very honored to be a friend, and I've learned a lot of things from you just in conversation with you. You know what I mean? Let's talk about fishing here. Now, me and you fished a lot. I mean, we've seen the change that we've seen. You're local here. You've seen it.
Yeah.
These people out here think that we've just lost our mind. We're making up this stuff. This is all just some crazy stuff we're conjuring up about snakeheads because we want to kill them. This is your livelihood. This is not just your livelihood. This is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people's livelihood here in Dorchester County that are being affected by what's unfolding in the refuge. There's a domino effect out the door, and we all know that. So talk about what it was like 10 years ago fishing here for us. I mean, you know how it was. We'd go over Key Wallace, and we'd fill buckets and buckets and buckets at 12, 13, 14-inch perch. You know what I mean? We'd go over Blackwater, 335, perch, yellow perch, big yellow perch, limits of yellow perch, big 13, 14-inch yellow perch. We did not see these fish disappearing until we saw these snakeheads. And that is the thing that I try to relay to the public, you know. We know Aberdeen Proving Ground is completely out of control up there, you know. I mean, it's out of control. So areas that can't be accessed and necessarily taken advantage of, just like our area here, there's so much that we can't get to. We're watching it happen in other places where these guys said it wasn't going to happen. We've got data to back it up. I mean, these fish at Aberdeen Proving Ground are so choked full of panfish in their stomach that they're eating. It's not even funny. So yellow perch, white perch, it's all in there right now. And I mean, lots of it. So let's talk a little about fishing here, man. How was it? And what have we seen? I mean, the ditches. Think about it. We never had fish in the ditches. You can go down any road here, and there's literally thousands of snakeheads in a ditch. Let it rip, man.
When I was going to Salisbury College, that's when I got into freshwater fishing. I'd always was saltwater. And I kind of like, well, these bridges here, I'm going to start going in. You know, I just want to try it. And it was a new adventure, you know. And after classes, I was driving back and forth. I was working and going to college, too. So I would stop there, mainly New Bridge and DeCourcy, because they were right on my way. I've done a lot of fishing at New Bridge. I love that place. And then some of the other, I didn't do too much at Aries because it was out of the way, but Droll Bridge, too. And it was so many fish. I would start fishing in February. My hands would be so cold, I couldn't even hardly fish. And the fish,
I know.
The fish would be, they would bite it, and all you would see was the bobber just move like that and go like that. You knew you had a fish. You throw them on the bank, throw them on the shoreline, and they wouldn't even flip. They were just like that. They were cold, you know. But it was. I would start fishing then, and you could see in the springtime, you know, as it warmed up, plenty of crappies, bluegills. The bluegills will make their nest right alongside the ridge, that sand and stuff. You drop a little thing in there and grab them. Let another one take its place, you know.
All right.
But all kinds of fish. DeCourcy, plenty of crappie, plenty of perch, all these places. When the snakeheads started showing up, they started coming down. And if people can say what they want, we've seen it. And
we got the numbers to prove it.
It's there. I feel like some of the perch now are probably spawning further down the river.
Yes.
Because we're, you know, trying to get away from them
things. I want you to talk about that because you look at the load of perch that's staying down there where you guys are that aren't coming up now. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. They're staying further down the river.
And the biologist said this, that, you know, that the fish may not come there anymore. Yep. You know, and what was there will eventually be gone, the resident stuff. And that's what we've seen here, you know.
It's just unreal what has happened, the change. Like you said, tons of crappies, bass, you know, and all. They're not going to, they can't compete with that. And I'm glad that we've got people catching them and trying to keep them in check. But as far as eliminating, we can't eliminate them. We just got to try to keep them in check. If we could get some kind of commercial market for them that where they're worth something.
I'm working on that, man. We're really working on that hard. I mean, we are Chad Wells. All of us are. We're trying to get something
going. I don't understand why it hasn't taken off yet. Because we sell so many here at the store.
Here we're Eastern Shore folks. We eat a dead. I'll pick something off the side of the road and take it home and cook it if it's still good to go. You know what I mean? I'm just saying. I mean, people out there that aren't used to this lifestyle, it's contempt prior to investigation. They hear the word snakehead. That is really what everybody's saying is the problem. And everybody says, well, let's make a new name. It doesn't matter if we make a new name or not. It's still the same fish. And the people that have that mentality in their head that, oh, I'm not eating a snakehead, they're still not going to eat it.
Right.
So
that can change.
I think what we're doing with the snakeheadlife.com recipes page, what you're doing here with putting them on the market, what we're doing about taking them other places and giving them to people for free to try, you know? I mean, look, if you're a restaurant out there and you want to try snakehead, shoot me a PM, okay? I'm going to give you 25 pounds to cut up and serve to your people.
You won't regret
it. For free, just so that you could try it, okay? I'll show you how to clean it. I'll show you how to flay it. We'll show you everything. If you need more help, we'll reach out to Chad Wells. Chad, you got this thing, baby. So, you know, I mean, it is delicious. I mean, we all know that. I mean, you like eating it, don't you, Tim? I mean,
I'll eat a lot of fish. I mean, I love fish. I could eat some fish.
Let me ask you this. I didn't ask you this. What is the weirdest fish you've ever seen in a net?
Well, we were pound netting. We caught a false albacore in our net. And the next week, we had a bass. We were had a net down there in the mouth of Nanticoke River. I mean, they were worlds apart. Like, what is going on here?
That's ocean and fresh water. Yeah.
What other kinds of cool stuff? Have you seen any tarpon ever in a net?
No, we never caught a tarpon.
No. Bull sharks, and you've seen them?
Yeah, one year we caught a bunch of them. And two of them we caught at the mouth of Transquaking big ones. And we had two small pounds there. They killed themselves in there because they couldn't move around enough. We caught one day, and somebody called us up there with crabbing and says, "You got another one in your net here." And this is in water that's, you know what, you can wade around in. And
how far up the Transquaking was it?
Right at the mouth of it. Right at the mouth in that first turn. We had a pound net there, caught one bull shark, and then the next day or two we caught another one. And we caught like eight sharks that year. They were all in shallow water. I mean, you know, we kind of like, well, I'm swimming in this. You know, they're long as a pickup, a back of a pickup.
Well, in Florida, they go up in those canals. And stuff. Yeah, totally
aggressive fish.
They can tolerate fresh water very, very, very well. Actually,
you were talking about snakehead a couple years ago when we had all that rain and the whole bay freshened up.
Oh yeah,
I remember that.
Yep.
I think that spreaded snakeheads over the whole bay.
Yep.
Because we were catching them. We had two or three in Hooper Strait. Down there.
We heard multiple reports.
Yeah, James Island.
They were everywhere. Yeah. So, I think that they were confined to the upper part of these rivers. But when that happened, they were catching them in crab pots, and they changed everything the whole bay.
They even had it this year. I mean, we had guys up Tillman this year after some heavy rains and had snakeheads in their crab pots.
The salinity levels that they give you for them, that's to reproduce. That's not to survive.
Yep.
So they can, you know, they can travel from one place to another with a higher
salinity. I remember calling you and saying, "Hey, I've got a snakehead crew down here."
I remember that.
And you're saying, like, "Hey, it, what color is it?" I said, "It's the same color as up in these rivers. The salt was not affecting it."
And remember when I started. And that was when he's the one who threw the flag 2 years ago on that, or 3 years ago.
Yeah, it was 2018, I think.
Yeah, so 2 years ago it was. I remember you, all you that rain. Me, I had all these calls coming in. That's when we reached out to the DNR and we had them coming in here and we were sampling the water salinity down that way. And we were seeing, the thing we couldn't figure out is that once we got out the rivers and that fresh water mixed with what was out there, the salinity levels were back up. And the fish that we saw out beyond that salinity line were weak. They were discolored.
Struggling.
We even saw it at places like Smithville, and that salt, when the salt came back up Slaughter Creek, you know, they were struggling
to
live.
They were confused. Dying. They were discolored. It was their whole life was changed.
Now, 2 years after that, now we're seeing the fish swimming out at James Island with rays at night when the guys are out there shooting rays. Yep. So
they've adapted.
See, that's the biggest thing that I want to look at with this fish that nobody's really looked at is how much adaptability do these fish have? I mean, how deep could it go? I mean, we know where we're at, but I see another whole level of snakehead infiltration, I'll call it, in the ecosystem, as the years go on. It's going to be different areas where these fish affect something. Kind of like Marnie was talking about the nutria and how they remove this and it affects that and that and that. So, I mean, that was really a good show too. I liked that. Yeah. A lot of people liked that last week. But, I mean, these fish are not like anything that we're used to here, It's not. I mean, it's not like anything I've ever seen here, Tim.
Well, they have to be able to adapt just for where they're from. They got to, basically, when the monsoons start, they got to breed and get it done.
Yep.
And that's what I hatch in 2 days.
Well, the adaptability of these fish has amazed me. When we first started catching them, you throw anything out there, and they were grabbing it. I mean, and what amazes me is I tinker with lures, and I like to find one that, I'll take two or three lures and put it together and make some, and it'll catch
I've
fish.
Seen some of the rigs he makes. they
catch fish, though. But listen, they catch fish. But I just by my work schedule, most time I always fish from a bridge. I'll just, stop there, and I'll fish
that's
for half an hour just to kind of get the stress off, all. And what I notice is I'll take these lures, and they'll catch and catch and catch, and then all of a sudden they won't. And I think these fish are territorial around that rip, and they've all seen it. They keep seeing it. Yep. The ones who bite it is gone, and the ones who keep seeing it, all of a sudden, it will not catch a fish. Yeah, and they adapt, I think. That,
and see, I've been talking a lot about this in PMs with people. Their memory.
Yes.
Yeah.
Their memory is just amazing. And, I mean, I'm going to try to get some permits so that I can do some more work on memory because I really, really want to see some stuff with that, how that goes, man. You know, I mean, these fish remember color like you wouldn't believe. I can tell you that.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. That
they don't forget 5 days later the color. They don't forget it 5 days too. Later.
Oh, yeah.
Like you throw a chatterbait at them, you can change colors the more. If it's an, I won't call it a confined space, but if it's in a space where they're pretty much there and there's not any more coming in, they'll hit one day and you're not going to get them on that. You got to try something different lure.
But see, even fishing around these bridges with so many people fishing now. When we first started, we know by fishing,
right.
You know. But now you got so many people and it's lures going bzz, 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 all these different things. I mean, these fishes here heard it and seen it all 100 times.
Now, Tim is a local. You know, we've seen the crowd. We've seen the stuff pick up. If you had anything that you wanted to say something about. You know, I do want to bring this up real quick, too, to everybody. When we had the parking issue, okay?
Tim was a big help.
Tim was a big help with all that. So a lot of y'all, when you see Mr. Tim around here, shake his hand and give him a little thanks. Because, you know, he's one of the locals that stood up and said, hey, you know, we need your help. We want you here. We think for the most part, 95% of you people are doing the right thing. You know, he really went to bat for a lot of folks. And, I mean, that meant a lot. To a lot of people that paid attention to what was going on. You know, I mean, to see this guy stand up. And there were several other people in the community that we're going to have over the next, you know, that also did too. I mean, this is God's country for sure. And, you know, I understand that, you know, people like you have been here forever and ever and ever. And you have a love for it that we don't ever see. So I understand, you know, when people get upset because they see trash or when they see people that aren't off the road where they should be. You know, I mean, I remember one time you messaged me a couple months ago, Kaz, you know, this whole parking thing, we need to talk to somebody about this. I just almost wiped that little kid sitting on the side of the road coming around because I didn't see him. He was sitting in camouflage. Gee, you know, and this happened like right before.
It took hours to get over
the whole parking thing. Tim called me one day, and he was really, really upset. You can go ahead and tell the story. And maybe you sharing that story will let the next dad out there know what to do for their kids. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So tell them what happened.
Yeah, I was coming to town. I think it was on a Sunday. Yeah, I was going to church, I believe.
Yep.
And I come up by Reagan's Corner there and headed up that stretch. And, you know, you go past that big pond, and then that's that little pond.
Turn, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm watching the one guy on the left hand side, fishing, and so I kind of, you know, I'm going to make sure I give him room, and I go over and I look, and there's a kid sitting in the grass with camouflage on, and I almost ran over his rod because he'd pulled his rod up and it was in the road, and I mean that you know if I had met a car. I could have killed that kid because I wouldn't have seen him. I was watching the guy standing, and I'm like, is a fish worth that? That's why I called you. I says, man, put it on Facebook, please. Watch your kid. If he was only a little guy, he should have been alongside the guy fishing. Yep. You know, why was he on the opposite side of the road in the grass with just like this? I couldn't see him until I was like, it jumped. And I'll tell you what, the whole rest of the day, I was just – you know, you had that feeling, you know, that something bad could have happened, and, you know, and it wouldn't have been my fault, but I would have,
trust me, I get it 100%. I mean, and that was kind of like the foreshadowing of what was to come the following 2 weeks, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the crowds were coming in, boom, you almost did this, people aren't listening to what we're saying about parking, and, you know, wearing something bright or something reflective, you know, if you're going to be there after dark. I mean, look, if you're down here fishing after dark, you really need something bright on, okay?
Yeah.
The average speed on the roads around here is really 35, but most folks do 50 because there's nothing around here, you know what I mean?
You're talking about speed limit.
I'm just saying, I mean, I do 110, you know? No, I'm just kidding.
That's the lower limit.
But no, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, and here's the deal. Like, you sent that message to me, the no parking stuff went down, and you stood right up and was like, look, I know we need help, but we can't shut it down.
No.
You know, and that was really good to see because a lot of locals here see the value in what's here. You know what I mean? And everybody thinks that everybody's getting rich. No, it's not everybody getting rich. It's that the value of the snakeheads here is bringing money to the economy here. It's helping the industry here. It's helping the you know, it's helping Parks and Rec. It's helping, you know, it's helping the politicians. It's tax. It's paying taxes. People buying things, you know.
Well, just Blackwater alone.
Yeah, I mean, look at that. The permits this year. I mean, the permits this year for hunting, gone. There's none available anymore. Yeah.
This is the first year I think they've ever sold out for hunting permits.
Ever. And now we're going to start this first cast program with Marsh and everybody over at Blackwater. This is going to be awesome. You know, if anybody's upset about what's happened here so far, you're going to get really, really upset about what we're bringing to the table in the next year. You know what I'm saying? So yeah. it's that's just a fact. I'm just putting it out there, and it's not anything to hurt anything here. It's to help maximize what we can do here to make a difference. You know,
that's right.
All these things that we're doing isn't to fill our pockets. All these things that we're doing is really to try to save a fishery, to put some conservation into play, and to just keep this place what it is, God's country. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, that's how I feel about it. If you really want to know.
Well, I think the big thing, and I thought about this before I came here, one of the things that I wanted to impress upon people, have manners.
Right.
Don't think about your own, you know, just yourself. You know, that's a nice way to put it, man.
Just have some manners. That's a good way to say it, man.
That's what's happening. You know, it's just like you see this now with hunting, so much complaining. I'm on public land, and somebody sets up a stand 50 yards.
So I'll just go. Well, let's go create a Facebook page for public and visitors.
You know, and or fishing or whatever. You know, don't throw your trash down. You know, pick up after yourself. Yeah. Just don't think about just yourself. You know, we have all kinds of stuff with duck hunters. You know, nobody needs to be setting 100 yards from you and setting their decoys out. Go down the shore a little ways, and you know, it used to not be like that, but it's become more and more like that. And you know. Just don't sit there and just think about only yourself. Think about the whole picture.
And think about the actions that you take, because your actions are going to they're going to affect the next person.
That's right.
You know, so.
And if it happens, it happens. I was hunting on public land not too long ago during duck season, and I went in and I walked down, and where I walked down there was a duck blind. Well, sure enough, here comes the duck hunters, and I mean, they were literally, I was 100 yards in, so I was 100 yards from them. I was right behind their blind, and they were shooting. I'm sitting there, and the guy pointed kind of, you know, probably wouldn't see any deer, but I started counting the ducks. When the ducks would come in and see how many I could see flying in and how many fly away. I couldn't see the water, what was falling. But, you know, I mean, it's just part of it, man.
It's part of life. And if somebody does, you know, okay. But we're seeing more and more of that, right, where people are just, you know, they don't care about anybody else. So I'm here and I don't care, and you know. And
I think another big part of that is if it does happen where you're already set up and it does happen to you, there's no need to be a jerk about it either.
Yeah.
Mistakes happen.
Yeah.
Like there's two sides of that coin where don't do it to people, but if it happens to you, don't be a jerk to that person either. So
Yeah.
Educate them, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
right. Exactly. Teach them, you know
exactly.
what I mean?
Yeah, we run into that sometimes, running into with duck hunting and stuff, where people who they might be their first time out there or
right.
whatever, and they're shooting the ducks 100 yards away and scaring everything, and all this kind of, you know. And
that'd be me.
Learn how to do some things and then go out, you know, and ask people what's the, go with people. And
YouTube, they can, man. You can learn how to duck hunt on YouTube.
You can learn how to do some stuff, but people just, you know, they go buy a dozen decoys from Walmart and go out in their fishing boat, you know, and they just go.
Instant duck hunter overnight.
Yeah, instant duck hunter overnight.
Add water duck hunter. Duck hunter in a can. No, I'm just kidding.
So, you know, it's just a lot of things have changed, and some things I see where people or just thinking about yourself, and that's it. You know, throw trash down, you know, open up a pack of, you know, they open up a lure thing, throw the thing down,
yeah,
you know, that kind of stuff. And somebody's got to pick that up, you know. And
when we were kids, my dad worked night shift, and we fished every weekend, mm-hmm. all freshwater up Caroline in Talbot and King counties. And I don't ever remember throwing any trash out because.
Yep.
I think I probably knew what the consequences were going to be if my father saw me throw some trash out. I mean, we just brought it home with us.
I was fishing with a guy one time. His name is John Kramer. I'll never forget this. And I was over there in my spot in this farm pond we were fishing. And I had probably 10, 20 cigarette butts there by 4 o'clock sitting there. He comes walking there and he goes, God damn. I said, what's the matter? I smell that stink, man. 10 yards from here, man. Pick that shit up. I said, I ain't picking it up, man. I ain't putting it in. This shit stinks, man. He goes, yeah, we'll pick it up. So he come walking over, man. As he got to me, I looked down at his shoes, man. He had cigarettes stuck in his shoelaces, man, everywhere in his shoes, man. And honestly, from that day forward, when I was fishing, that's where my cigarette butts went, in my shoes. My fishing shoes were the stinkiest ass, cigarette smelling, fish gut. Oh, man, you have no idea. A pair of shoes would be done in like 2 months, man. Well, not even that. Probably a month they were gone.
I bet the cigarettes probably smell better than your normal feet.
Probably, yeah.
Did you ever think about taking them cigarette butts out of them?
No. What I did is I just gave my shoes to Riley. I tell Riley, after I had them a month, here, dude, here's some free shoes. We're going to wash them off, dude. They'll clean up just fine, yeah. Dude.
Yeah, so. They were white, but not a brown.
I'll tell you what, man. This was just another good show, man. Absolutely. I mean, gosh. I hope everybody out there, I mean, I enjoyed these stories tonight, you know what I mean?
That's the best part.
And the best part is we didn't even tap half the shit he knows, man.
We're an hour and 10 minutes in. I know. And we're already over time, and there's still so much more to talk about.
Do we get paid for overtime on this?
I wish. Yeah. We don't get paid for any time on this.
I know. Everybody thinks we're getting so rich on YouTube.
And we get the double time and have nothing.
Yeah, double time and have nothing. Hey, I did want to... I did try today, Eddie. These are, what are they, daisies they're called?
They're
cake-covered pretzels. I'm screwed, man. Before I forget about that, look, if anybody out there is catching any dragons, you want to get yourself a nice fiberglass Mountmade, Mr. Barry Taylor, you can reach him at 717-577-7437. $20 an inch, six-month turnaround. These things are pretty nice, man. I mean, good detail on it. You know what I mean?
Great detail.
Yeah, fantastic.
So check him out. You know, if you got something you want to have mounted up or anything like that. Also, for those guys out there that are into doing the skull mounts underground, we're going to have a little piece next week on how to do that, how to bury your skull, how to get your skull nice and white, how to bleach it out so that you can start saving all your skulls. And then we'll have a contest in here. First person, whoever has the most skulls accumulated by next year, we'll give them a free bass boat.
That's all you. That's all you.
Got a lot of them.
Yeah.
Dope.
So then we got our MEPS Angler of the Week.
Angler
Spotlight of the Week. We got this week is Perry Reichlin. He's got a nice string.
I like that picture. That was a very, very good picture.
Few snakeheads, few catfish. Man, he tore it up. He did a good job.
Thank you very much for coming, and thank you for your service.
Yeah, man. So.
Need to see somebody put them on string. Most people don't do that anymore.
That's true, yeah.
I just shoot mine on the 44 and throw them in the cooler.
Dynamite, you just pick up the piece.
You guys ready to give away some free freaking crabs or what?
Yeah, man, that's all you.
Do you want to sing the song with me, Tim?
No, definitely not.
Come on, man.
You got to give away your crabs before you do your song.
It's time. It's now. The Sunday Funday giveaway on Thursday out here at Blackwater's Edge Podcast. Folks, look, this week, we're giving away some. Look, the crabs have been just off the hook down here, and I got to be honest with you. It's about over. So we're probably going to fish this weekend, and we might leave some out to fish next weekend for Thanksgiving. But it looks like they're going to be drying up real soon. The water temperatures dropped. The crabs have really moved off the grounds a good bit. So this week, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to give away one dozen large crabs to Julie Everard. Hope I said that right. And I'm going to give Kenny Klein a dozen of them extra large crabs from down here on the Eastern Shore. So before we leave, let's leave you with a little crabby jingle. And we always want to thank you for watching the Blackwater's Edge podcast. We appreciate everybody that shares and invites their friends and everything like that. And just keep spreading the word. We're going to keep doing what we do. We're going to keep giving away all kinds of stuff. And before I forget, whose birthday was it today you said, Gary? That
your cousin.
Which cousin? Slick Rick. Slick Rick. Tricky Ricky. Look, for your birthday, look, I'm going to leave a pack of these bad boys down there for you, my friend. My cousin Ricky Seagard. Happy birthday. Look, that guy's taught me so much stuff you would not even understand. Most stuff I learned down here came from him. So thanks, Rick. Anyway, my crabs, they have three first names. It's Heavy, Full, and Fat. My crabs, they have a fourth name. Do you know what they are, Tim?
Mustard pack.
Absolutely mustard pack! So, if you ask me where they're from, they're 100% guaranteed Maryland number ones. Right here on the Eastern Shore, and they are massive, they are full, and they are heavy. At the crab stand, here's a fact I know for sure you're coming back. Kapow! Kapow! Kapow!